Welcome to the View My Seats podcast for Tuesday, February 10th. I'm your host, John Lord. With me today is Ryan Belangi from GolfNewsNet.com. Ryan, Charlie Sifford, the pioneering golfer who broke the PGA Tour's color barrier back in 1961, died last week at the age of 92. How can Sifford's impact on the sport of golf be felt today?
One sense, I wish I had a better answer for you because the only one African-American guy at the time on the PGA Tour, and that's Tiger Woods. But in the other sense, that's an incredibly important story. Regardless of how Tiger's playing today, 79 PGA Tour wins and 14 major titles. Tiger Woods credits Charlie Sifford for inspiring his father, Earl, to play golf, who taught him how to play golf, at least in his early stages. So were it not for Charlie, and this could have been denied one of its greatest champions. And so in that sense, Charlie Sifford's modern impact is incredibly huge. But I think he woke up a sport that needed waking up desperately. And it unfortunately still took another 30 years for Augusta National, from when Sifford broke the color barrier, to admit an African-American as a member. It took some 25 years after he broke the color barrier for the PGA Tour to say it would no longer go to clubs that had exclusionary membership policies based on race. So while he was incredibly talented and important, I don't think his impact was felt until he was done as a competitor. And in that sense, I think that's kind of a sad thing that he didn't really get to experience firsthand the things that he ultimately changed and paved the way for. But that's also true for so many folks who paved the way. They don't get to enjoy the fruits of their labor, the generation or the one after that that does.
So many of Sifford's accomplishments have, at least for me and for many of us, have come to light in his passing, which is a shame. But when you look at what he accomplished as a man and a player, it's truly astounding. So back in 1961, when he broke the color barrier, he went on to win two PGA Tour events, never played Augusta, and was always fairly bitter about that. In fact, African-American didn't play Augusta until, I believe, Lee Elder in the mid-70s, 1975. Charlie Sifford was a World Golf Hall of Famer in 2004. Won the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2014. He even received some inspiration and words of advice from Jackie Robinson, who we all know broke Major League Baseball's color barrier back in 1947. There's a great quote from, I believe it's from Sifford, but he kind of uses what Jackie Robinson says. Sifford said that Robinson asked him if he was a quitter, and Sifford said no. And Robinson responded, well, good, if you're not a quitter, you're probably going to experience some things that will make you want to quit. And that quote really, really sticks with me today because I look at the sport of golf, and at least on the surface, the sport of golf is still battling with a real lack of diversity. And I'm wondering if that lack of diversity today in golf, both at the amateur and professional levels, has more to do with race or socioeconomics. What do you think?
I think they tie hand in hand. I think research, and coming from my background, and at least educationally speaking, in public policy, shows that the system is kind of tough for African Americans and minorities in general to fail and to be stuck in a cycle of poverty that is almost unbreakable unless you have a talent like Tiger Woods, or like many African-American athletes, is coveted and is seven and can lift a family or community out of that cycle. And the way that golf is perceived, it's certainly not a first option for a minority or anyone from a poor background to play in as a sport because the barrier to entry is so high in terms of cost, not only in terms of equipment, but the play, that it's overcome. It's impossible to overcome. compare that to pretty much any other participatory sport in this country. Basketball, baseball, which is struggling in urban environments. Soccer, which is flourishing, but not only African-American. Think about what it takes to play those sports. It takes a ball, you know, some base equipment, and clothing. And that's it. It doesn't take money every time you play. You can play by yourself. You can practice by yourself. You can get better by yourself. But even if you play at a team level, it's not that expensive compared to the rigorous tournament golf or getting lessons or getting more equipment or anything like that. So I think ultimately golf's problem is a socioeconomic one. It just so happens to be so well tied into the social and economic standing of minorities in this country.
So Tiger Woods won his first major championship, the Masters, in 1997. And since that time, we haven't really seen an increase in diversity on the PGA Tour. And I don't know what the status is in country clubs across the country as far as, you know, how much of the issues that we face as Americans involving race also impact the sport of golf. Do you see golf having a race problem today? And is that the reason why there haven't been more professional golfers who are black?
I think its reputation precedes it, maybe a little unfairly, but it does precede it. I mean, we talked about 1991 was the first year there was an African American member of the Augusta National Golf Club. That same golf club didn't admit female members till 2012. Royal Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews, which you don't exactly think of Scotland as racist or sexist, but they finally admitted female members and announced it today after 260 years of existence. So if you're not a white guy, golf probably isn't marketed to you, and frankly, it's not your first thought. And I know that there are a number of clubs in this country that may not be able to explicitly say whites only, but they're thought of as whites only, and they're thought of as men only, white men only. And I think that reputation kind of carries over into the participation aspect of the sport. And the other part of it is Tiger Woods is one guy, and he is one transcendent guy, transcendent of the sport, transcendent into pop culture. However, there's not a crop of a generation of players of African-American descent or any kind of minority background that are following Woods or came up alongside Woods. I mean, when Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color barrier in 1947, the Negro Leagues were filled with talent beyond measure that could have kicked total ass in Major League Baseball. And unfortunately for them, like Charlie Sifford, they didn't really get a chance to showcase that talent until they were past the prime of their careers. Charlie Sifford won twice on the PGA Tour, officially speaking, and he didn't really do it until his 40s, which is incredible that he kind of had that longevity and that perseverance, that courage to still play great golf in a place where he was a pioneer and threatened with his life on a regular basis. Meanwhile, you've got Tiger Woods who kind of exists not to be an advocate for the game of golf, but to be an advocate for lower income children in urban environments to go to college, get a college degree. And that's going to be his bigger legacy, is through his foundation. I believe that's what he believes should be his bigger legacy, not to try to promote kids and drive them to the point that they are trying to be a one in a million talent to play professional sports and succeed at them, but rather to do the simple, seemingly simple for so many thing of going to college, getting a degree, and assuring yourself a better life, because that breaks the cycle of poverty more than anything else. A college degree has shown to break the cycle of poverty and at least create job opportunities that wouldn't otherwise exist without that degree. And I think that's where Woods sees his value to society. And that might be incredible. It might be really disappointing for what people expect from Tiger to have changed everything. But I think he sees that as much more potent, and I kind of agree with him.
We're talking with Ryan Blangy from GolfNewsNet.com. And the PGA Tour has had initiatives in place for quite some time now to try to encourage more of a diverse crowd to play the sport of golf. And you made a very good case for all the good that Tiger's done as far as trying to provide kids with an opportunity to go on to college, not just to go on to professional golf. But I still kind of wonder whether or not golf as an institution really has its full support behind initiatives to increase diversity. And there's no way to argue one way or another on this, but it just strikes me as odd that in 2014, when you watch golf, you have, you know, all sorts of different nations represented from around the world, but you're really not looking at all that much in regards to racial diversity. So I'm still left wondering if the institution of golf really wants change and what would need to happen in order for that change to take place. So clearly a transcendent golfer like Tiger Woods isn't going to bring about the change. Does the change happen when the golf becomes less expensive? Does the change happen when manufacturers and golf club managers realize that they can't continue to charge what they do for their equipment, for their greens fees, that there needs to be some other sort of policy to get new golfers onto their course, to get new golfers into their gear? Because as an industry, the golf industry, the golf equipment industry is suffering. Hemorrhaging money. I mean, you look at other sports that are doing incredibly well, like basketball and football, their apparel, their equipment sells to kids. But golf is really having a tough time selling their equipment. So kind of bounced all over the place. But what do you think? Does golf really want to see change? And what can it do to bring about change?
I think golf genuinely wants change. I think it genuinely wants more people to play the game because more people to play the game, no matter how rich or poor you are, if you can afford it, you're lining the game's pockets. Customer is a customer. You want the customer. However, I think as it's kind of showed pretty clearly over the last 15 years, it has no idea how to attract players en masse from a youth perspective to the game. They just don't know how to do it. And for all the great effort he has made in trying to instill the values of life through golf to children, it really was never built out as a participatory program. It was built as an education program, almost an extracurricular activity that had life skills related to it. And I think they kind of missed on that aspect of it, and they kind of assumed people who go through that program would remain golfers for life. And I think many have it. Certainly not a wide enough to consider a massive participant. So, and you know, as for equipment, there are several really good manufacturers of junior golf equipment, but no one's ever really heard of them, and they're not very well marketed. And I think golf's real problem is it doesn't know how to make junior equipment to scale and be successful at it. You don't have Callaway, TaylorMade, Titleist, Ping, even Nike, which I find kind of stunning, making junior golf equipment. Titleist is probably the closest that tries to kind of court kids early to their brand with golf ball seeding, and that's typically what they do. They don't do it with clubs. They do it with golf balls for your junior golf teams, your high school golf teams, collegiate golf teams. They do that, and they build loyalty for later in life, assuming you stay a golfer. But golf apparel isn't all that sexy. Most people don't want to wear a polo shirt in a regular setting. They want to wear it if it's a kind of going out setting or a special setting. And the really unique thing I think about the sports that succeed among youth is that not only is the base equipment cheap, but the pros have equipment that is cool, is accessible, and reasonably affordable for kids of pretty much any background. And that's just not the case in golf. And I'm not sure why the light has never gone off to say, why don't we take a loss leader here, make some junior equipment if we're a Callaway or TaylorMade of the world. I would love Nike to do this, make that equipment, and get it in the hands of kids who otherwise would not play the game, but if you kind of subsidize their introduction to the sport, may get interested enough and work hard enough and find the way to make it work economically. And it may, and they may not. They may walk away. They may find it boring or too hard to pull off in terms of finances. But that is the way to get kids to play golf, is to give them an opportunity to play and wear and look like and act like the guys they see inside the ropes if they find them cool enough. And yeah, Puma had the good sense to have Ricky Fowler wear an orange flat-bill cap that kids wear all over the joint at golf tournaments. But that's a hat. That's not clubs. Hats are easy to sell. Clubs are harder to sell. But clubs, if you get them in their hands, mean the future for the sport and a broader future for the sport. And I think for whatever reason, smart people don't get that.
Talking with Ryan Blanger from Golf News Net, we're talking about Charlie Sifford, who passed away last week at the age of 92. And Ryan, I mentioned this earlier. Charlie Sifford never had a chance to play the Masters, never actually stepped on foot of Augusta National. And there was a lot of bitterness involved in that decision, but also in the fact that that there was no black player to play the Masters until 1975 in Lee Elder. And just hearing this story and hearing this history didn't give me the warmest and fuzziest feeling about Augusta National. And I actually was fortunate enough to see a few practice rounds there last year. And looking back on my experience at the Masters, albeit a practice round, it is stunning when you look around at the crowd, how pretty much everyone in the crowd at Augusta National looks exactly the same. You talk about a lack of diversity in the sport of golf. I have never seen more of a total middle-aged whitewash than at Augusta National during those practice rounds. How do you feel about, and you also mentioned the RNA, today finally admitting honorary women, female members. How do you feel about tournaments like the Masters and Augusta National upon hearing about all this history with Charlie Sifford and the really exclusionary practices of places like Augusta National and the Royal and Ancient?
Augusta National has come, this is really strange to say, because it just sounds ridiculous out of context. But in 2015, Augusta National has come a long way from where it was 3 years ago to play the Masters. They have an African-American member, they have have gone out of their way under Billy Payne leadership to try to appear at least more inclusionary and recognize the club's importance to the sport. Because I think it took Billy Payne to realize and fully implement Augusta National's influence as a de facto governing body of all. They have a greater influence participatory branding level than the USGA, the RNA, the PGA of America, probably combined. And I think it took that recognition to make some very important steps forward for the club's perception and for the sport of golf. And for them to basically forged the drive, chip, and putt contest and hosted, I think, is huge from a junior perspective. I think that may actually have a chance to work in terms of building youth participation in the game. But if you do look back on Augusta National's history up until really 2000, I mean, we're talking 70, 80 years of their history. It's not good. It's not flattering.
No, it's not.
But I also think if you look at sports history up until, you know, say the 70s, it wasn't all that great. Unfortunately, golf in particular lags behind other sports in terms of inclusionary practices and how they treat people equally or unequally, depending on which group you're talking about today.
My point was that when you stand on the grounds and you take a look around at the other people watching this sporting event, my perception is that it's indicative of, you know, the very problem that we're talking about, how the sport itself is struggling to attract a diverse audience. And therefore, I mean, it's perhaps unreasonable for us to expect that the people playing professional golf are going to represent a more diverse group of people.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, as you said, it is awfully pale at Augusta National in April. And well, it's awfully pale any time. But I think part of that is the Masters is somewhat unique. It's like Lambeau Field. I mean, if you have a Masters badge, you hold on to it for the rest of your life, and you give it to your kids, and they give it to their kids, and so on and so forth. So if, and this is true, 50, 60 years ago, you got a badge to Augusta National, and you were white, which was everybody, then you gave the badge to your kids who were white, and their kids who were white, and their kids who were white, and that practice essentially locked up minorities from being able to attend the tournament unless you fork over a huge sum of money to be able to buy a badge from a badge holder, and hopefully you get in and they don't lose their badge. So that makes Augusta National unique in that regard because of the way it handles ticketing, but it also dams it from a diversity perspective because that creates generations upon generations of people who look exactly the same and probably act the same or pretty close to the same at Augusta National, which is the world's most important golf tournament, and I don't care what the RNA says. And I think that actually hurts the sport. And maybe that's something that the folks at Augusta National don't consider, or they don't care, or I don't know. Maybe they don't think the makeup of the gallery is all that important. But I think non-white folks see when there are a lot of white folks somewhere and the crowd is not diverse. It tells you something about who's attracted to it. And I think that kind of hurts the sport because it is the game's most visible tournament. And then you go to a place like Players or Phoenix Open or other tournaments where there are fun holes and fun environments, the crowd's more diverse. I'm not going to say it's representative of society, hardly, but it is more diverse. And I think it would look at least a little bit better to a broader audience if it had that same kind of mass appeal as the Masters does.
Yeah, certainly it's much more diverse socioeconomically. I mean, the people who go to the Masters, like you were saying, these badges being passed down from generation, they have to, they're in a position where they can afford that opportunity. But I'll tell you another thing that you observe when you walk around the grounds is that the audience for an event like the Masters isn't necessarily getting any younger either. So now you're left with a couple of challenges. You're left with both a lack of racial diversity and also a potential age issue looming for the sport of golf, which, you know, if you want the sport of golf to take these issues seriously as far as trying to really make their sport more diverse, trying to make their sport popular, perhaps, you know, the fact that there is that lack of diversity won't do it. But if your viewing public population is getting older and you're not attracting younger golfers, then perhaps they have to make some changes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go back to the point about generations and kind of hanging on at Augusta National. But there is an age problem in the sport, particularly in terms of participation and viewership. I mean, if you look at the TV numbers, the overwhelming majority of golf's audience is white guys over 50. So my audience at Golf News Net is largely white. They're a little younger, but they're wealthy, but largely white. And the sport really does have a huge age problem going forward. It made the calculation that the generation of baby boomers would do what their parents did, just double the size, which was they would, the previous generation, the greatest generation, they retired and went to the golf course. A lot of them did. And that kind of saw a big spike in golf participation. And the calculation was made that the same thing would happen again, and there'd be 40 or 50 million golfers instead of the 25 million playing in the sport today in this country. And that was the guiding force behind building thousands of golf courses, where that at one point the National Golf Foundation said there needed to be a golf course built every day for like 10 years to match the growing expected demand for golf. And they eventually revised that, but that stuck. And it took off with land developers and real estate developers. And it created ultimately a huge contributing factor to the economic crash of 08. So, you know, all that to say, the next generation, our generation, Gen X, which is now bigger than the baby boomers, is not any more inclined to play golf than our parents. So at some point, I do believe there will be some kind of cultural backlash against the lack of an attention span, the unwillingness to sit down and do something for more than 15 minutes. I think that backlash will happen. I also think there will be a backlash against the move to urban environments, and it's starting to already take shape, in fact. But those two things will take time to unfold, and eventually golf will come back. Eventually golf will get younger, because it has to. But it's not going to come right away, and it's going to be a little painful for a while.
Yeah, so, you know, while we're talking about how golf faces a couple of issues here as far as their target audience, and their target audience is, or their audience at least, is getting older and it remains white, in talking about this, I couldn't help but feel we could also be talking about the sport of baseball. And you talk about some of the challenges that Major League Baseball goes through, where, you know, people would argue this point, but baseball is very much a regional sport nowadays. It's not a national sport like say football, perhaps even basketball is becoming. I mean, there are pockets in this country where Major League Baseball is incredibly popular. But when you go to baseball games, you're still dealing with an audience that is skewed towards the older and the white. Certainly, you know, where I am from in the Northeast, that is the case. And so in many respects, it's similar to the same issues that golf is facing. And Major League Baseball will tell you that they don't have a problem because their ratings are up, you know, their television audience is up, their attendance is up. So they don't tell you that there's an issue. But when you go to these games, you're left to wonder that in, hey, 10, 20 years, who's going to be going to these baseball games? And so you could make the same argument with golf.
It's a good point. And I think that in baseball sense, at least in larger urban environments where there's a growing Latino population, there's at least some potential. I'm not saying it's happening now, but there's some potential for the audience to grow, or at least kind of change in terms of its makeup, because baseball is still very popular with folks of Latin descent. So I think there's still that opportunity for baseball, at least. But it is a regional sport, and it did agree kind of make itself into a regional sport because of the length of its schedule. 162 games is just impossible for a national audience to pay attention to for, 30 baseball teams. So I think that ultimately baseball is at least in a little bit of a healthier position than golf is. Because again, at the end of the day, to be interested in baseball, you don't really have to play it. Most people, if they do play it, they played as kids, so they're not still playing it. But it's easy to hold on to because it's kind of easy to understand. It can be exciting. It's something you can watch on a Saturday afternoon. But its audience is clearly older. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I think that golf's biggest issue, and we talked about it earlier in the podcast, is socioeconomic. Golf's participation hinges on how people feel about their wallet entirely. And that's whether you're rich or poor. Its future depends on how we feel about our ability to have money that we can spend on fun stuff. And if that money is worth 5 hours of your time on an afternoon to go get really annoyed and play bad golf. And if you feel good about that, then you're going to play golf. And if you don't, you won't spend that money, or you'll find something else to spend that money on. And that is the fundamental problem golf has to address in terms of how it appeals to people. And unfortunately for the sport, there's not a whole lot golf can do to line people's pockets with money. And even though the economy is coming back and has been supposedly coming back for 5 years now almost, that comeback hasn't really been felt by anyone except the highest of high, not even upper middle class folks and above who would play golf, or middle class folks and above who play golf, but the 1% have seen an extraordinary percentage of the benefits. And so most people are still waiting to improve. I feel like their life is better and their economic situation is better. And so if that problem can't be addressed in this country, then golf is doomed, at least on a broad scale. Golf will exist, but it won't exist on a broad scale if for another generation another 5 or 10 years, we're just kind of all stagnating here, waiting for either our benevolent, wealthy overlords or the government to figure out a way to get more money into people's pockets that need it the most.
Well, you know, it's funny. When we started talking about Charlie Sifford, we talked about how Sifford was, in fact, directly influenced by Jackie Robinson. And now we're talking about both kind of golf and baseball dealing with very similar issues in regards to race and a lack of racial diversity, socioeconomic diversity. It's left me wondering, and you've made the case for why golf's big problem is a socioeconomic problem, which is tied to, you know, our issues of race in this country today. But another issue which, you know, I wonder how much of a factor this has on the real lack of diversity in golf today is if you're a young African American, you are going to be attracted to sports where there are other African Americans playing. And so if you are, you know, watching golf from home on TV, you're not going to see a lot of people who look like you if you are a young African American in this country. And the same thing can be said about baseball. You know, professional baseball has diversity, but we're talking about diversity with Latin America and other parts of the world. You know, as far as African Americans go, participation in Major League Baseball is way down at record lows.
Yeah.
So we started talking about how Jackie Robinson and Sifford broke the color barrier way back when. But now part of the issue, I think, is that young black kids don't see a lot of other black athletes playing those sports. Therefore, they're not going to want to play those sports. What do you think about that?
I agree. I mean, think about it. Think about the makeup of the NBA. Think about the makeup of National Football League. Those are the two highest percentage African-American athlete sports in this country. And that, other than football's health concern, they're the most popular, at least on a national basis. So I think that tells you something. I think that tells you something about where people as a society are going. Even white people are interested in diversity. And the breed of people, white people that don't want to see that are going away. So golf's participation problem, yeah, really does hinge in part that, yeah, you like to golf with friends. I mean, there are plenty of loners who love to play golf, but most people golf with friends. If you're an African American kid who is interested in golf, wants to give it a try, and you want to go with a friend, what are the odds that there's going to be a friend, much less two or three, that want to go with you? Not very good. And I think part of that's the problem. I don't know how golf addresses that either, because it's not like you can all of a sudden just put an increased number of African Americans on tour and say, go get them, we're going to diversify the sport. That wouldn't work. And I think that efforts made to this point to try to get African Americans and Latinos to play the sport have kind of failed. And I don't know what the message is to try to make that work, but you almost need some perversion of the game to try to get minorities interested in it. I know that there are a lot of people who hinge participation hopes on Top Golf, which is a driving range that's starting to sprout up at more and more places around the country, but they're in few cities in this country. Maybe that'll help in the long term, but we're not going to see that benefit for 15 years. So I think this conversation will continue, and there will be people who try to do things that inspire minority participation, but we won't know if they work for a long time. And that's golf's problem, among so many things as it relates to participation. It tries something for 6, 9, 12 months. If they don't see big results, they abandon it. And they abandon it at their own peril, because if you have 25 different ways to try to grow participation, one for every 6 to 12 months, then nothing can be proven to work and nothing can be truly proven to fail. And it's that impatience that, ironically, is hurting the sport.
You know, we're talking with Ryan Blanchard from Golf News Net, and it's really fascinating because we're talking about diversity and we're talking about the lack of diversity in golf, and it is, I think we both agree, it is clearly in the best interest of golf to diversify. So this is something, and you talk about how it's very difficult for the powers that be to kind of stick with a single initiative, and perhaps that's just a portion of the problem. But I think what's clear in our conversation is that it is in the best interest of the PGA Tour, of the USGA, of all these entities, that the sport become a much more diverse sport, that it attracts a much more diverse audience. Otherwise, it's going to continue to struggle. And certainly with the apparel, as we covered earlier, it's not as attractive as other sports. And so golf will continue to have issues. So it is in the best interest of golf, for golf, to become more diverse. Quickly, and I'll let you get out of here, Charlie Siffert wasn't the only pioneering, legendary professional golfer to pass away recently. Billy Casper passed away recently. I think it was over the weekend as well. Thoughts on Billy Casper's impact on golf?
Unfortunately, I never had the opportunity to meet Charlie Siffert, but I did have the opportunity through Billy Casper Golf, the management company he lent his name to in 1989 and co-founded, to have spent a few hours with him in 2014, which obviously his last full year of life. And I think he's so underappreciated because he was so soft-spoken. He didn't really care about, he just didn't care about being a star. He cared about providing for his family of 11 kids, 6 of them adopted. And he didn't care about winning the biggest tournaments because the paycheck was basically the same. He just cared about winning. And he won 51 times, 3 majors, second place 3 times in the PGA Championship, and once in the Masters. Had an opportunity probably to win the Open Championship had he played it more often, because he just had that low hook that was perfect for Lynx golf. But because he didn't kind of fall in line with Mark McCormick like Jack Nicklaus and like Arnold Palmer did in the 50s and 60s, he kind of got left out of what was the big three. And really, Gary Player became the big three because of his late resurgence in his career, because of his longevity. And Billy Casper didn't have that in terms of the length of career. I mean, he wasn't really relevant after 1975 in terms of PGA Tour golf. And Jack won another major in 86. So his lifespan as a pro on the PGA Tour was bigger. But Billy Casper won for at least once for 16 consecutive seasons. He won more events in a decade-long span than any other player on the PGA Tour while Arnie and Jack and Gary were at the peak of their powers. So he was an incredible champion. But the thing, I obviously never saw him play golf, at least at that level, but I did see him in action as a human being. And I will always walk away thinking he had the most unique delivery, the most unique way of conversing with a crowd or even a single person than I've ever experienced. I mean, Arnold Palmer talks to you like you're your best, he's your best friend. Like he's known you forever and he just hasn't seen you in a long time. Gary Player is just so fired up to talk about literally anything that it's infectious. Jack is just so sage and he knows his place as golf's greatest champion that he just kind of offered it. But Billy Casper made me feel special in a completely different way than Jack Nicklaus wishes he has. And in such a unique, deliberate way, when he spoke to you, it was like he crafted the words he was telling you just for you, or just for that audience, just for that moment. And you might have heard it, and I did hear it several times over, but he was reaffirming himself every time he said something he probably told you before. It was that important to him. And for him, he had so much confidence as a competitor because he believed in his decision-making ability. Not only an incredible course manager, but the human being, that he believed in his decisions and that they were the right one, and that was going to lead to good things for his life, and it did. He went 51 majors and had a marriage, 62 years old, children, 6 adopted, 71 grandchildren, 51 grandchildren.
It sounds like a man of incredible conviction, and 51 victories. I mean, that is something that I was unaware of, and you look at the list of the top PGA Tour winners, and Billy Casper's name isn't normally associated with that list, but he's on there. 51 total victories.
With more wins in the history of professional golf than Billy Casper.
That's amazing.
Absolutely wild stuff. And I will say that it's just kind of funny to think about it. A sad one. But Billy Casper will go to his grave, or went to his grave, knowing he has more potential than a guy he does not like.
Who is that? You said, I'm sorry.
Then Phil Mickelson. Phil Mickelson. And Tony Jolo. And so he goes to his grave, no more wins than the guy. And I think wherever he is, as long as he deserves the game, he'll be happy. He's very happy.
Oh, jeez. That's very interesting. Well, Ryan Blansey, thanks for taking the time. It was a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.